Okay, well, thank you, Arnold, and thanks very much to you and Mark for running such a fun meeting. I've enjoyed it a lot. I think everybody else here has too, from what I can gather. And thanks to all of you for sticking it out this far. This talk is inspired by some of the things I've done in these papers here. PSCF is the Perspectives in Science and Christian Faith Journal. Some of it is a genuine physics paper. And I think the title of this, I hope, will become clear later on, but I thought about it because physics, I think, is at an edge point in its history right now, at least fundamental physics is. And in some sense, when we push our faith, we're sort of at the edge of what we can understand and believe. So let me orient you, I hope, like this. In 1869, a guy named Dmitri Mendeleev figured that the basic elements of nature, which by around that time people knew all substances were made of a finite number of basic things, they could be arranged in a pattern, and this is the earliest periodic table I could find. And we know there's been a lot of progress since then. This is the modern periodic table that has all the various elements with some of their properties in it. And I'm guessing how many people saw this at least once in their educational career? Good, good. I'm trying to start with common ground. So we know a lot about this, and everything in this room is made out of combinations of these various elements. Where we are now in physics is at an analogous place in the subatomic world. And I thought to illustrate this, I would march you through how this happened rather quickly to give you a feeling of how the picture is fleshed out. When I was born in the 1950s, we didn't know there were things called quarks. In 1961, George Zweig and Murray Gell-Mann independently suggested that particles like the proton and the neutron, those are the things that make up all the elements. Hydrogen is one proton, helium is two protons, two neutrons, lithium is three protons and three neutrons, and so on. They're made of things called quarks, and they proposed there were three of them, and they had names, up, down, and strange. And we already knew the electron and a partner to the electron called the neutrino existed. And there was another funny particle, unstable. It was called the muon, and it looked just like the electron in every way, except it was heavier. And it would unstably decay into the electron and some other things. These things at the bottom are called leptons. Oh, by the way, in terms of the movie we saw last night, this is going to be heavy on the left brain side, this talk. For those of you that either need to be reminded or those that are not familiar, a proton is made of two of these things and one of those, two ups and a down, and a neutron is two downs and an up. And that was the basic idea. And there were a lot of other unstable particles seen in subatomic experiments in the 50s, lots and lots of them. And they seem to have a haphazard pattern, but Gell-Mann and Zweig figured out that if you postulated these three things existed, all of the mess of those patterns in the 1950s could be seen. And we had light, whose basic particle was the photon. So as we march through the years, 1961, all matter, by the way, everything in this room is made of combinations of these four things. Down, every particle in your body is up, down, electron, and believe it or not, some neutrino, since every person has some potassium-40 in it, and you radiate about 340 million neutrinos every day. So, and that, all other matter is unstable that has the heavier stuff in. So as energies and particle experiments got cranked up, more things were discovered. The muon neutrino was discovered a little bit later, and it was discovered the quarks actually had three different kinds of charge, nuclear charge, analogous to electric charge. They called this color, not because it's like red, green, and blue, but rather to express the fact there are three different kinds of nuclear charge. We do call them color, but they're not like the colors you see with your eye. So here it goes. In 1974, another heavy quark was discovered called the charm quark. And then a heavier partner to the electron and muon was discovered called the tau. And then we discovered the bottom quark. And then gluons. Gluons are the particles that stick quarks together into protons, neutrons, kaons, pions, and in turn stick those together into what we call the nucleus in the atom. We discovered in 1983 there were three other kinds of things analogous to photons and gluons called weak bosons, and they are the force carriers of the radioactive force, the thing that makes anything radioactively decay ultimately is connected with the behavior of these things, just the way that anything connected with light is connected ultimately to the photon. And anything connected with nucleus is connected to gluons. Then we discovered in 1994 the top quark and the tau neutrino around the year 2000. And then finally in 2013, the Higgs. And in 2016, I've got the graviton here in dotted lines because technically we haven't discovered the graviton directly, but we now have the strongest evidence possible that this thing exists. This table, I just want to point out, everything, every particle in each row is identical to each other in all respects except its mass. Light, medium, heavy. But apart from that, you cannot distinguish the particles in the top row from each other. The same for the middle row, the next row, and the bottom row. There is no pattern to these masses. They just get heavier in different ways. No one knows the reason why at this point in history. Furthermore, we know it stops here. We know there isn't a fourth generation, or rather, if there is, it must have its neutrinos with very different properties than the first three. And just this charge down here is electric charge. This is negative charge of electrons that you've probably heard of in chemistry. Two ups and a down, two-thirds plus two-thirds minus one-third is plus one. That's the charge of the proton. The reason why people found it difficult to accept quarks is because of this fractionality of charge. But ultimately, this won the day, and we have confirmed it with experiment. So the point of showing you this exercise is that in 2018, today, we can summarize everything we know about the subatomic world in one chart, analogous to what we can do with the chemical periodic table. Now, I don't expect you to be, I can't even read this print from here. I just am showing you this picture to express this remarkable human achievement that in my lifetime, the idea of quarks hadn't even been conceived when I was a toddler, and now we have mapped out the subatomic world. This is the triumph of 21st century physics in the last 5 years. All of us have lived through two of the most remarkable scientific discoveries in history. One is that of the Higgs boson that was first thought to exist 50 years ago, but, 55 years ago now. It took 50 years from its conception to finding it in experiments at the Large Hadron Collider. And this is a picture of one of the bazillions of events they find that ultimately let us see the Higgs. And 2 years ago, we finally found gravity waves. This was 100 years from theory to experiment. The basic idea of Einstein's theory of relativity is that gravity is fungible like a rubber sheet. And just the way a heavy rock will warp a rubber sheet, a heavy object like a star or even a planet will warp, literally warp, space. And if space is warpable, you should be able to, if you shook a heavy rock, just the way you would get ripples of rubber going out, if you have two heavy things crash together, you'll get ripples of space and time coming out. And we found these, well, I didn't personally, but the LIGO collaboration found these 2 years ago. So we have now discovered, at the risk of inappropriately echoing Kelvin, everything there is to be discovered, and I'll clarify that in a minute. Let me say a little bit about the Higgs, because this is going to matter for what I want to say theologically. What was done in the Large Hadron Collider is you collide two protons together. Here are the three quarks stuck together with gluons in these protons, and you smash them together at energies of 8 trillion electron volts. What does that mean to the everyday person? When you light a match and make fire, that's caused by chemical energy. And the typical energy of an atom in the fire is about 10 electron volts. So this is about 800 billion times per object greater in energy than what you have in a typical fire. So they crash together, and the way particle physicists figure this out is you just measure the stuff that comes on out of collisions in a substance, in a quantity called a cross section. And if all you have is stuff smashing together and flying off into other stuff, you get a predictable fall off. But if you make a new particle, you get a bump in the fall off. And so this bump is the Higgs boson. And the location of where this happens energetically tells us the mass. And this is the mass we now know for the Higgs, 125 billion electron volts. If you want to see this in kilograms, it's 2.22 times 10 to the negative 25 kilograms. If you want to measure it, for those of you more familiar with chemistry, it's about 130 times as heavy as a proton. So the Higgs field, there's two kinds of Higgs things that you could get confused about. The Higgs field is something that pervades everything in the universe, and all known particles feel it. And it's kind of causes a drag force on particles, and that drag force is what we call mass, or what we perceive as mass. So just the way if you dropped an anvil in a swimming pool and dropped a rubber ball in a swimming pool, they'd both fall down, but the anvil would go faster because the buoyant force, the drag of the water on the anvil, is less than it is on the rubber ball. The same kind of thing is what the Higgs does. So the Higgs doesn't drag electrons very much, but it drags the top quark a lot. The top quark is really slowed down by the Higgs, gets very, very heavy. The Higgs particle, this thing they discovered, is the simplest excited state of a Higgs field. Or to put another way, if you were in a swimming pool and you just randomly splash, you'll get waves and ripples going around. But if you had a group of people consistently pushing the energy all in one direction and all in the other, you'd get a glob we call a wave. And that wave glob to water is analogous to the Higgs particle in the Higgs field. The Higgs boson is like a glob of Higgs field. It doesn't last very long. It decays very quickly. But it is an identifiable structure. The exciting thing about this is a mechanism for where mass comes from. Your weight on the scale ultimately is due to this guy right here, this Higgs boson. It does not explain, however, what the different values are. So the question of why is the electron a light particle? Why is an up quark heavier? Why is a bottom quark even heavier? Now becomes a question. Why does the bottom quark have a stronger drag with the Higgs than the electron does? So we can put in these numbers, and they have this unified mechanism, but the actual values are not explained in the model. What about gravity waves? Well, what was seen originally in the first LIGO observation, we now have 4 or 5 of them, is the collision of two black holes. Here's a picture of what we think it looks like, and these ripples are literally the ripples of space coming off of the collision, which, by the way, releases an energy equivalent to 3 times the rest mass energy of the sun. You know, Einstein's E equals mc squared? Put in the mass of the sun to that equation, multiply by 3, and that's the collision energy in the waves. Because they're a billion light years away, it's a very tiny ripple on Earth, but not too tiny that the LIGO people couldn't see a matchable pattern at the two different stations in Washington and in Louisiana. And what you actually can do is match very carefully the in-spiral to the collision to the, when it's a bigger black hole, it vibrates and slowly settles down, and it produces a predictable wave pattern that is now very well matched between theory and observation. So it's a triumph of what we call the standard model. Today we have a physical theory. We call it the standard model, and it describes every known subatomic particle, every known subatomic interaction. It includes gravity. All the particles in this model have now been discovered. And all experiments are in agreements with the predictions of this model. And here's an example of that. One way of checking it is, as I said, the Higgs boson, when it's formed, has to decay. And it can decay into photons, or those Z and Ws responsible for radioactivity, or those heavy electrons we call tau leptons, or bottom quarks. And what you can do is compare the measured value relative to the prediction of the standard model. And you can see everyone lies within limits of error along what we would expect from this standard model, hence the name standard. So you might think we'd be happy. It's a bit like your mother would say, "Oh, that's very good, dear. You've now completed your science project. Now please go and brush your teeth and go to bed." But we're not happy. We're not happy. Everything works except this model has 27 adjustable parameters. And we don't know where they come from. In other words, we have to have 27 different experiments to tell us what these numbers are. The theory doesn't tell us. Once we have them, we can predict tons of other things. But where do these 27 numbers come from? 12 of them are the masses or the drag coefficients with the Higgs field. Another one is the mass of the Higgs. Four of them are mixing angles. One of them is a vacuum mixing angle. Four of them are the force strengths, and one of them is cosmological constant. There's the 27. It doesn't include dark matter. To the best of our knowledge, we're not completely sure, but dark matter doesn't seem to be made of stuff that is in the standard model, which means it's not made of periodic table matter. Why isn't there antimatter? There is, at the beginning of the universe, there seem to be equal quantities of matter and antimatter, but today we know the universe is predominantly matter, and the only way we know how to make antimatter is in subatomic particle experiments, or there's a tiny bit in cosmic rays. And most perplexing to theorists is we really don't know how to make gravity a quantum force. All the other forces obey the principles of quantum physics. Gravity, we don't know how. But most perplexingly is experiments see absolutely no new physics, which wasn't the way the script was supposed to go when we turned on the Large Hadron Collider. I started asking about 10 years ago, what if all they see is the Higgs? Oh, Rob, they're going to see something new. Oh, Rob, there's going to be new physics. Well, you know what? They found the Higgs, and that's it. Every experiment agrees with what is standard. There is not a scrap of evidence for new symmetries like supersymmetry, no evidence that these particles are made of even tinier particles, no evidence for exotic things like mini black holes or axions or nothing. Nothing, nothing. So we're at the edge. And this is what I mean by physics at the edge. We're at an interregnum. On the one hand, yeah, we've confirmed in my lifetime the basic model, the periodic table of subatomic physics. But on the other hand, we have these puzzles and no experimental guidance as to where to go next, and lots of theoretical ideas that aren't working out. What about faith? Well, here maybe we're a bit more familiar with the characters of faith. Mary, when she meets the angel Gabriel, is at the edge of her faith. What? How can this be? I'm a virgin. You're telling me I'm pregnant. Doesn't fit. Job, why this suffering? This poor guy with all the boils on his body. Esther, was I really chosen for a time like this that somebody like me has to go and petition the king? Daniel in the lion's den. a very famous children's Bible story that pushes his courage to the limits, his courage in God. And Thomas, I won't believe it until I see for myself. And the risen Lord, that's why I love Thomas so much. He's the scientist in the Bible. And you know what? God loves the scientist. Like we often say, oh, it would have been better if Thomas hadn't. I love the fact he says, all right, you know, okay, check it out, man. So, when we go to the edge of our faith, here's physics and theology. I found the God particle. I found God. So this guy is asking, what is the world made of? But theologically, what does it mean when we find the answer? And I do physics partly because I'm just as interested in this question as I am in that question. And perhaps each of us are here too in our own ways. And in exploring the edge of our faith, I think we want to have open-minded conviction, right? And that's a bit of an oxymoron like educational television or jumbo shrimp or something like that. But I think we do. I think on the one hand, we want to store up knowledge, as it says in Proverbs. The wise store up knowledge. The mouth of a fool invites ruin. Of course we want to be open enough to new knowledge, to the possibility we might be wrong. And yet we also want to say with Job, I know that my Redeemer liveth, despite the fact the evidence at the moment looks against it. How do we balance these things? That's what I want to do for the rest of the talk from the perspective of physics. What I'm going to do is I think there's three basic things we don't understand I'm going to talk about. One is nothing. I'm going to talk about nothing because we don't understand nothing. We also don't understand everything, so I'm going to talk about that too. And believe it or not, we don't even understand something, so I'm going to talk about that too. Well, what do I mean by that? I'm going to flesh these out. One is our vacuum is vacillating, and it raises theological questions. Our universe has particular features that are very puzzling, that have to do with our understanding of everything, and our universe is not as straightforward as we might think it would be. At a very basic level in physics, it is contextual. So, the edge of nothing. Nothing is nothing, right? Well, not in quantum physics. Nothing is what we mean by a vacuum. What's a vacuum? Emptiness. But in the quantum world, emptiness literally can fluctuate all these subatomic particles in and out of existence perpetually. So here's the standard model in a different way, where the leptons and quarks and gluons, photon, the weak radioactive guys and the Higgs are grouped together, and the blue lines tell you what interacts with what. And it's a bit complicated, as you can see. Here's to remind you of what the Higgs particle and field difference is. What I want you to do, or what I want to do, is focus on this part right here. This line from the Higgs to the Higgs tells us that the Higgs boson interacts with itself. And that turns out to be quite significant. So here's that part of the picture, and the way we understand this line right here is with an energy diagram. So let me put on the axis. This is a measurement of the potentiality of energy. So this is high energy potential, this is low potential. And really, it's not a whole lot different than my wallet is at high gravity potential here. If I let it go, it falls to low potential. So when you see an energy diagram like this in physics, it means if something is here, it wants to go to the lower place. Just the way if something is higher up, it wants to fall to the lower place. So the horizontal axis is a measure of how strong the Higgs field is. So shortly after the Big Bang, the universe is hot, the Higgs field has high energy, and it's right up here. We're at this high energy state. The Higgs boson has zero magnitude. But, and particles have no mass. So there's the Higgs at the beginning of the universe. But as the universe expands, it cools down, and that means that the Higgs field dilutes in energy. So this guy says, oh, I can get to lower energy. So I'm going to go down here. And we can measure the magnitude of this Higgs field in units of energy, and it turns out it's 246 billion electron volts, which is about 246 times heavier than the proton. This is not the mass of the field, this is the size of the field. It's a distinction. Empty space is now not in this high energy state, it's in this low energy state. This little gap here is the energy of empty space. It's the energy of our vacuum. It's the energy of nothing. But this is a puzzle. Why? Well, you can calculate what that energy should be from quantum physics, and you get a number, and the number is 10 to the 120 times larger than what we observe. Theory says it should be 10 to the 112 ergs per cubic centimeter, but experiment, observation says it's 10 to the minus 8. Okay, well, if you're out by a factor of 10 to the 120, your theory is a bit of a problem. This is called the cosmological constant problem. But even more puzzling is this tiny little bit here is 72% of the total energy budget of the entire universe. Our stuff here is only 5%, not even 5%. When I was a kid, everything, the kind of stuff in this room was supposed to be the total energy budget. Now we know it's only a small part. But even more puzzling, this is what was discovered after the Higgs. If all we have is the standard model, then the vacuum, nothing, is unstable. And that was found out by these guys here, Butazzo et al., in this paper, 2013. Now that the Higgs is discovered, what if the standard model is all there is? What if there are no new particles to be discovered? Well, it turns out this energy diagram changes a lot. This part here that I've shown is actually this small part up there, and the quantum corrections induced to this from the known particles mean that we have a lower energy vacuum. And so this safe place we think we live in is actually unstable, and the Higgs can tunnel to a much lower state of energy. We don't know what that will be, but we know it's less than this, and less by a lot. So you have this diagram, and it turns out this crucially depends on how heavy the top quark is and how heavy the Higgs is. This dot is the real world. The top quark is about 172 GeV, 172 times the proton, and the Higgs is about 125 times the proton. And these circles are the error bars around that. If the top were too heavy, our universe would be unstable, which means it already would have decayed and all of us wouldn't be here. If the top quark were light enough, we'd be in a region of stability. Likewise, if the Higgs were heavier, we'd be in a region of stability. But we're not. We're in a region of metastability. Here are the measured values right there. In other words, metastability means someday our universe is going to decay into this lower energy vacuum. Nothing is unstable. There's a line between where it's metastable and where it's fully stable. So what the heck does this mean theologically? This vacuum eschatology is catastrophic. If a bubble of true vacuum formed right now, that's the way it would work. You'd get a tiny fluctuation, right? You could, in this room, get a tiny little fluctuation of vacuum, a state of nothing that would be lower energy than the nothing right now. That bubble, that little region, would expand out at the speed of light, annihilating everything in its path. It would happen so fast, we'd be gone like that. And then it would eat the Earth, and then the solar system, and then the Milky Way, and then the local cluster, and they would just annihilate the whole universe. I'm not making this up. So I think, what does this mean? Is this a built-in feature of creation? Did God deliberately create a metastable universe? Or maybe not. Maybe this is a reason to think, no, God would create a stable universe. There must be new particles that rescue us from this vacuum disaster. Is it sinful? Or not? The question is there. If the vacuum is unstable, it raises different questions about what it means for God to create. Now, I think one thing it means, we hope in nothing less. Our hope is nothing less than, you know, the hymn, right? We need it, certainly if it is unstable or metastable, ultimately we must rely on God for our very existence. Now, we sort of know that already. But I think it expresses there is a need for a physical eschaton. Our hope is in the stability of the new creation. Heaven and earth will pass away. My words will never pass away, says Jesus. Or, you know, maybe it really is a built-in feature. The creation is subject to frustration, not by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it. And the hope, the creation itself, will be liberated from its bondage to metastability. Oh, I mean decay. So that's problem one. Problem two, the edge of everything. If you think, you know, thinking here goes nothing, well, that could be the start of everything, and in fact it is. Now, I don't need to say a lot about how we get there, because Dennis Danielson did it very well at the beginning of the meeting, but way back when, I think everybody here knows, the universe appeared to be geocentric. Looks that way. Everything goes around the Earth. Venus had no phases. There was no observed stellar parallax. People didn't believe this because they were stupid. They believed it because, yeah, kind of looks that way. Sun goes around, moon goes around, stars go around. And this model is computationally efficient. It lasted over 1,000 years. In fact, I've been told that if you put the Ptolemaic model on a computer and calculate the motion of the planets, it's actually more efficient than Newtonian physics. But we don't believe it because Newtonian gravity in the Copernican context is better. And as Dennis points out very well in his books, people were not originally hostile to this idea. Here's a quote from Nicholas Cardinal von Schönberg saying, you know, I learned you mastered the discoveries of the ancient astronomers uncommonly well, but also had a new cosmology in which the Earth moves. The Sun occupies the lowest and central place. Remember the lowest. This is excrement. This is a step away from you know where, from he who will not be named. Unless, so I entreat you with earnestness, learned sir, unless I inconvenience you. But so nice people were polite those days. Unless I inconvenience you. Do your students ever ask you if they inconvenience you? To communicate this discovery of yours to scholars and send me at the earliest moment your writings. They were interested in this stuff originally. But I digress. What I want to point out is the Copernican principle has been very powerful and effective in physics. And its chief lesson is, be very wary of assuming uniqueness to your own observational viewpoint. And where it's relevant is in cosmology. It suggests that our observed local universe means that it looks the same in all places as well as all directions. In other words, it's been elevated to a cosmological principle that the universe is homogeneous and isotropic at every point. What does that mean? Well, it's not hard to understand. Homogeneity is like a brick wall. If you step to a different place in a brick wall, it looks pretty much the same. It doesn't look the same in every direction, but it looks the same from place to place. A sea urchin or a porcupine is a thing that, if you're in the right place, looks the same in all directions. Now, what we see observationally when we look at very large distances is this feature. This principle allows us to infer that feature. And we have no reason to believe it is not correct. Here's an example of homogeneity and isotropy for the universe in terms of how we think galaxies form. It's not fully smooth, featureless. Rather, it's like being in a Harry Potter movie with all the spider webs. We have spider webs of galaxies, and at a large enough scale, spider webs look pretty much the same in all places and all directions. But it doesn't mean it's featureless. This is a big cluster of galaxies. Here's a thin thread. Here's a void. There's a void. There's another void, etc., and etc. Is this principle universally applicable? It's been elevated to the principle of mediocrity. It basically says if you draw an item at random from various possible categories, it's more likely to come from the numerous category than the not, right? If you have your drawer and most of your socks are black and maybe, you got 20 pairs of socks and 17 are black and 3 are white, grab one, you're probably going to pull out the pair of black socks, right? Makes sense. People think this perhaps applies to everything in the universe, but there's a place where it does not. You can ask the question, is our universe a typical specimen out of all possible ones? And there's one way in which it's not for sure, that this cosmic mediocrity would suggest the universe is the same at all times. But we know that's not true. We know it has a developmental history. People posited this, the perfect cosmological principle, same in all places on average, same at all times on average, but we know the latter is not correct. It has a developmental history. It will look very different a billion years from now than it did 10 billion years ago. In fact, here's a cartoon picture that helps us ask this question. Here's the Big Bang, the injection phase of the universe, about 13 billion years ago, almost 14, when it started. Then it has a directional development. It has a developmental history, just as all biological organisms do. And finally, today, it has very particular features, selection kind of effects. There are special laws of physics that take us from here to there. There are special structures of nature that don't seem typical. And there are special initial conditions, so it seems, that get us here. So it doesn't appear to be typical. So are we in a cosmocentric universe? The universe began at a particular time. Time moves forward everywhere. We don't look out in a telescope and see stars unevolving. We could. Logically, it's not forbidden. We could look out there and say, oh, look at those aliens. Time's going backwards for them. We don't see that. Quantum physics appears to be universally operative. Normal matter, as I said, is rare. Here are the different percentage fractions. But most curiously is our universe appears to be biophilically selected. Its life-permitting features are a narrow subset of the range of possibilities. And furthermore, our cosmos is delicately balanced between being positively curved, where it would collapse like that, and negatively curved, where it would explode so rapidly nothing would form. This balance is extraordinarily delicate. And I could say a lot about that. I don't have time. And the problem with knowing if we're in a cosmocentric reality is not easy to go to a lab and make another universe. You could apply to NSERC for grant funding, but I don't think they'd give it to you. Brandon Carter first raised this kind of question. The basic idea is, let's compare our universe with a set of possible universes allowed by the known laws of physics and ask, are the life-permitting features that should come out, we know they come out in our universe because we're here, are they typical or are they not typical? And the answer, compressing a lot of things, is our universe appears to be very special, very finely tuned for life's existence. Here's an example of how that works. Let's consider an atom where we have electrons, protons, and neutrons, neutrons and protons. If the neutron were 0.2% lighter, if this mass of the neutron, here the red numbers are the ones we could adjust. If we adjusted that 9 to an 8, all neutrons would decay. We have no atoms, no molecules, no life. We have hydrogen, that's it. We need more than hydrogen for life. What if it were the other way around, if it were just a tiny bit heavier? Well, hydrogen wouldn't be able to form. We'd only have heavy water or heavier elements. We'd have no water. Without water, we have no life as we know it. That's an example of this. Now, this speciality runs against an anti-theological grain. So to revive Copernicanism, people have asked, could we be living in a multiverse where our entire universe is a small part of a much larger structure, where there are lots of universes all over the place, gazillions? Do the finely tuned features here indicate that we're a tiny part of a much bigger thing? So so if you have a lot of possibilities, right, a drawer mostly black socks, we're the white socks in the drawer. Well, if you have a drawer with lots of kinds of socks, well, maybe there are white and we happen to be the white socks. I'm not talking about baseball. It's thought you cannot test this idea, and for the most part, that's true. But there's a sense in which it's a teeny weeny bit probable. The idea is this. You have this vacuum, a false vacuum of higher energy, and then you can get a bubble of true vacuum, which would be our Big Bang. And our true vacuum could go to an even truer vacuum, as I said earlier in the talk. Maybe. But this can happen again and again and again. And this is a way of generating lots of universes. You have a gigantic false vacuum, and then here's a bubble of universe, another bubble, another bubble. And it's possible for these bubbles to collide. And there is, in the cosmic microwave background, a region of the sky that's notably colder than we expect it to be on statistical grounds. It's called the cold spot anomaly. Some people thought it might be a supervoid, a gigantic void of matter, but that has recently been ruled out by the Gamma Survey. Maybe it's a statistical fluke, but maybe it's evidence that one of these bubbles collided with our own early in the universe. Maybe. Maybe, maybe, maybe. But if it is, it raises the question of everything exists. And Scientific American, being a little more sensationalist, infinite Earths and parallel universes really exist. Do they really? Well, everything means everything, doesn't it? This goes beyond normal science. We have, in any normal science, we know the things we can see, but we know there are things we haven't seen yet. We know that what exists is certainly larger than what we can observe, even for the universe as a whole. The question is how much larger. We have everything that could exist, but we think does not exist. For example, one aspect of this is you could imagine a universe where you chose not to go to this conference. If the multiverse is right, way out there you have a duplicate that didn't go to this conference. But the rest of the conference is duplicated. Now, we think that doesn't exist. But if the multiverse does exist, we have this big problem of how we bound that which does from that which does not. And we can't use observation to do it. How do we demark the possible from the potential? We have to rely on unbounded resources to do this job. And this is the problem with the multiverse idea. Once you start, where do you stop? If you give unbounded resources, even in a scientific context, literally, you can get anything you want. Might be statistically unlikely, but that's a very different statement from saying it can't exist. So this goes beyond normal theology. What would Jesus say? I'm the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but through me. Jesus affirms a single universe. Oh, but in my Father's house there are many rooms. If it weren't so, I wouldn't have told you. Jesus affirms a multiverse. Which is it? Well, we have this problem. The usual theological problem is, why is there something instead of nothing? We're pretty sure something exists. This is theology's old challenge. The multiverse, when you extrapolate it, indicates everything that could exist actually does exist, including all the different possibilities your life might have taken. Why is there something rather than everything? Is there a particularity to existence? This is what I call the puzzle of particularity. In Latin, we have creatio ex nihilo. But we also have to deal with, I think, creatio ex omnia, Omnia is everything. Nihilio is nothing. If I'm pronouncing the Latin right, I'm not that good at Latin. So we have these theological pictures. The usual one is we imagine God conceiving a universe, maybe various kinds of universe, but he instantiates one of them, and we have some kind of ontological distance between God and the thoughts of God and the actual physical creation. In the beginning, God creates heaven and earth. But God asked Job, where were you when you did this? Tell me if you understand. In the multiverse idea, God's thoughts are created all the time. Whatever God thinks of, God does. Does this really make sense? There's no telic selection. If you have a one-to-one correspondence between God's thoughts and God's actions, what function does God serve? We need some kind of particularity. The string gods, string theorists say, oh, Rob, you're such a wet blanket. God is powerful. God could create lots of universes. Maybe God does it like this. He imagines all these different versions of of kinds of multiverse, but there's the string multiverse, and we know that's right, because string theorists are always right. And so then you create string theory, and then the string theory gives all these actual different physical universes, about 10 to the 1500, roughly speaking. That's a numerical estimate that came in a paper about 15 years ago. I'm not making that up either. I'm making any of this stuff up. I'm really not. I know you might think, I'm really, really not. So he is in all things, before all things. We do have, I think, some interesting theological issues, less practical than climate change, I do agree, but the questions are there. So the idea here would be some mathematical principles force God to select this theory, and theory S has many different physical realizations, and we are in one of them. Now, this is an improvement over the general case, but I think not good enough, and I think there's theological and scientific work. How do we deal with particularity? What are the limits to Copernicanism? Last thing, the edge of something. We have the known knowns, for example, the age of the universe, the expansion rate of the universe. But we have the known unknowns, dark matter and dark energy. We're still exploring what these are. And we have this energy budget. This actually is an older picture. This should be 72% now. I forgot to update this. But the point is, we know normal stuff is only 5%. Normal stuff is periodic table matter. Dark stuff, it's gravitationally attractive, but apart from that, it doesn't seem to have anything to do with periodic table matter. And then we have the unknown knowns. What the heck? Wave functions, quantum interference, and quantum contextuality, and that's what I want to close off with. Physics in a contextual universe. Normal physics and normal theology tend to be similar. We tend to assume the universe is objectively real. We tend to assume that all measurement errors can be arbitrarily reduced, that the outcomes of experiments doesn't matter how you perform the measurements. But in quantum physics, this isn't right. We can't reduce all measurement errors arbitrarily. And we can't seem to have both objective reality and non-contextuality together. Why is nature like this? Let me illustrate this. You've already seen it if you went to some specialized talk, the famous double slit experiment. Take a gun that fires particles and have them go through two slits and collide with a wall. You'll get two lumps. If you take water waves and do the same thing, you'll get a diffraction pattern. Want to see it? Do it with light right now. Put your fingers close together, but not so close they're jammed. Look at light. You'll see little dark and light fringes. That's the same as you're doing a slit experiment there. Now, what actually happens in the real world, if you fire electrons that are supposed to be like particles through two slits at a screen, well, you see all these dots. Oh, yeah, that looks like particles. Yeah, it looks like particles. Well, is it? Is it? And you see this light and dark and light and dark pattern emerge in experiment. You go from particles to wave-like behavior, but all you're doing is firing more and more electrons. This is a real-world experiment. There's the paper. that describes it's been done a lot. Somehow, all the electrons at the beginning or know what the guys later on are going to do and vice versa. How can they know? They don't have any brains. They're electrons. And yet they somehow have this particle wave duality. There's lots of applications to quantum physics. Transistors, lasers, computers, lots of physical effects. I'm not going to talk about them. But what the weirdness does is give us an analogy to an economic conundrum we're often faced with. You want to repair your house. You want it to be good. You want it to be fast. You want it to be cheap. But you can't have all three. If it's good and fast, it's going to cost you a lot of money. If it's fast and cheap, you'll get a lousy job. And if it's good and cheap, anybody have a contractor work on their house? You can't get all three together. We looked at this in the context of physics, Danny Turno and Reto Inicio and I in this paper. The same conundrum appears to exist between objectivity, there's a real world out there, determinism, the laws of physics determine the future from the past, and independence. I can do whatever experiment I want. If you have these two without this, you don't really do experiments. If I can't choose how to set the dials of my devices, I'm not really doing an experiment. If I have these two together, the world is not objectively real. And if I only have these two, I can't make any predictions. There's no determinism. Well, we want all three of them, but what we show is you can't. You get two out of three. Pick your poison. Do you want the world not to be real? Do you want the experiments to be meaningless? Or do you want us to be unpredictable? This is expressed in this Schrodinger cat idea where you have a radioactive element that by quantum physics after 1 hour has a 50% chance of decay. You're an animal hater, so you connect it to a hammer that's going to hit a jar of poison, so when the thing decays, the hammer falls, the poison breaks, killing the cat. But if you don't look at it, as Schrodinger pointed out, the cat is 50% dead and 50% alive after 1 hour. But it's nuts. Cats are either dead or alive. How can you test these crazy ideas? Well, you can do them with light, using a gizmo called a Mach-Zehnder interferometer. How am I doing for time? Oh, okay. Let me go ahead then and just... I didn't see a five-minute call.
Sorry.
All right. What you can basically do is send light through a splitter and have it go on two different paths, but shift the phase of the light along one of them. If you put a beam splitter in at the other end for two detectors, then you find the light has a wave-like pattern. The blue detector is wavy as you change the shift. The red detector gets a wavy pattern as you change the shift. But if you take this out, you get a particle pattern where you get a 50-50 chance as the photon is split. The counting statistics determine whether you have this or this. If the statistics are like that, you've got waves. If they're like that, you have particles. It's actually possible to choose reality in the following sense. When the photon goes through a beam splitter, you can decide afterward, randomly, whether to insert the second one or not. What that means is that the photon, once it's gone through, doesn't know if it's going to be a wave or a particle. This is called the delayed choice experiment, and what you can do afterward is collect all the data when the beam splitter was in and all the data when it was not in, and if the photon really knows if it's a wave or a particle, you're going to get different patterns compared to the ones that you would get had you left the second beam splitter in all the time. So this is called delaying the choice. Well, what happens when you do this is you still see the photon being a particle when the beam splitter is out and a wave when the second beam splitter is in. So in this sense, reality is contextual. If I collect all the data when the beam splitter happened to be not in, put it together,
I find no matter what the phase is, I get 50-50 counts. The photon is like a particle. If I compare all of the ones where the beam splitter is in and look at the data, then I see a wave-like pattern. The photon is a wave when the beam splitter is in, even though it was randomly put in and out event by event. Now, how contextual is quantum mechanics? We have this phenomenon called superposition. Normal coins, let's take a coin, normal coins are either head or tails, but if I could make the coin quantum mechanical, it would be an indefinite combination of head or tail, where the quantity alpha, if I square it, is a number that tells me how likely it is to be tails in this picture, whereas if I square the number beta, that tells me how likely it is to be heads. I can also put two coins together, give one to Alice, give the other one to Bob, and I could ask, okay, what happens if they both get, what happens if one gets heads and the other gets tails? I can do the same kind of thing. If left gets tails, right gets heads, and vice versa. A quantum coin in the lab is like a photon. And photons have two polarizations. You can call one of them as like heads, the other one's like tails. And if you combine light in a certain way, you can actually entangle both of the polarizations. So you can have head up sideways combined with sideways up for the photon, just the way you can combine head-tail with tail-head. What does this mean? Well, it means the probabilities of everyday life become very different. If I have two people flipping coins randomly, then normally I get a 25% chance that head-head, head-tail, tail-head, or tail-tail will occur. About one quarter of the time I'll get each combination. But I can entangle coins in such a way that whenever Alice gets heads, Bob gets tails, and whenever Alice gets tails, Bob gets heads, and it never, the other two possibilities never occur. This is a very strange probability pattern. It does not occur in normal physics. There are other ways of combining things together. This is the most extreme way. So this leads us to back to Schrödinger's cat. Schrödinger's cat can be in a combination of alive with the poison bottle unbroken and dead with the poison bottle broken. The problem is this runs against everyday knowledge. It's not something we see in everyday life. And we still are struggling with how to understand this contextuality in the subatomic, atomic world relative to the apparent lack of contextuality in the everyday world. And so this led us to the paper I wrote earlier, that in some sense, we have an unpredictable unreality. If realism means that something must be either a particle or a wave, and if determinism means the future can be predicted from the past, we show in these couple of papers that these ideas are not compatible. If you want realism, you've got to sacrifice some determinism, and vice versa. So you have these very strange things that I showed in this chart. You can't construct a deterministic theory that makes both types of these objective properties real. You can't be both a wave and a particle. The experiments tell you whether it's one or the other. So theology in a contextual universe, what's the connection? What is the role of objectivity and determinism? It's a bit like balancing love and justice. We want a just God, we want a loving God. And it's in Christ that we unite these two in what one might call a Christ-like contextuality. But it's the ongoing problem of the church, of the people of God, to wrestle with this contextuality of love and justice. So let me, in my probably 90 seconds, mention an application of this that I didn't think of. It's in terms of perichoresis. The idea of the Trinity, that the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit are mutually indwelling. This is like quantum entangled God. And people have pointed this out. Polkinghorne, for example, has pointed out that perhaps quantum physics has something to say about the differences and the unity between Father, Son,
and spirit, and that mutual insight can be gained by considering both. So I'm sorry I had to zoom ahead at the end, but this is the edge of the edge. This is the basically the end of the talk. Instability, the instability of nothing versus the particularity relative to everything versus the contextuality of existence. I think physics has a lot of new theological questions to present us with. This is the kind of stuff I like to think about. I'm very thankful to God that I actually get paid for doing this. My wife is even more thankful than I am. She knows I can't do anything else. So thank you very much for your attention.
That was absolutely fascinating. I'm interested for you to follow up on how Romans 8 connects with the metastability and stability question. It's something I've been reflecting on myself. But particularly in light, a biblical scholar would say that the word decay is a very bad translation. That word is actually used, for example, in the Septuagint of the flood story, where human violence has destroyed the earth. It's a more ecological word about destruction and corruption than about decay. Though Plato and Aristotle do use it to describe the sublunary realm, but that's not in the Bible. So just wonder what you think about that. It's very interesting.
Well, I mean, I certainly think, I guess my view would be this. I think it's very valuable to have textual criticism and see what the people at the time actually meant. And they might not mean what we think now. That's a very fair statement and line of inquiry. But I would also say that doesn't mean that we have to think the way they did way back then. We have more knowledge scientifically and, I would contend, theologically. So I would say the question is there if the vacuum decays. How could we not ask it? And where I think scientists, at least of the ilk I associate with, get frustrated with Christians, they're just so out of touch with what's really going on in the subject. We should be thinking, not everybody, but some people should be thinking more about the theological meaning of possible vacuum decay. Now, it's not as important as climate change. I get that. It's more destructive, by the way. Good news is, at least it's not our fault. But nevertheless, I think it's rooted in this. Even though the original word might not mean what I've conferred it now, I think it's a fair statement to say it's an outgrowth. That would be my view. And it's a reasonable outgrowth based on reasonable inference from what we know now.
Well, I guess I'm interested in knowing how entropy compares with that, because entropy isn't that kind of a slow motion resulting in the same thing, a flattened out universe.
That's another form of eschatology, that if the vacuum doesn't decay, we face in a different way, that as time goes on, eventually all the stars burn out, eventually they get gobbled up by black holes, and eventually the black holes, to the best of our knowledge, will decay as the universe continues to accelerate into a cold, dark, lifeless nothing. But the nothing is always the same nothing in that picture. It's sort of, you know, I mean, it's death in slow motion instead of death in fast motion. Polkinghorne has said this in some of his books. The bigger problem for Christian faith is not origins, it's eschatology relative to what we know about science. And what? How do we understand a good and loving God in a universe that is ultimately fated for some kind of doom? And I think there are answers to that, but I think we tend not to think about them very much as a community, and we should.
All right, let's thank Rob once again.